Well, good evening, everybody. I just want to mention again, this is the book that we're going to be using this year, all right? United States Catholic Catechism for Adults. Tonight, we're actually going to get into the text of the book, United States Catholic Catechism for Adults. And remember, what we're doing is an RCIA for Catholics. RCIA is a process that someone goes through in order to become Catholic, but many people have said to me, I wish there was something like that for those of us who are already Catholics so that we can learn our faith in a new way. You know, we learned it as kids, but we need to learn it as adults. And it's when we relearn it as adults that I think we start connecting with that faith in a new way, and it begins to make a whole lot more difference to us. We're going to be doing chapters 1 and 2 tonight. Chapter 1, My Soul Longs for You, O God, the words of the psalm that we just heard. And what it's about is we're going to be looking at, first of all, the desire, the hunger that is within the human heart for God. And then this chapter 2, God comes to meet us, where God begins to reveal himself to us and comes to us. And ours is not simply a religion that is about how do we seek God and find God, but that our religion is about a God who seeks us and seeks to find us. So chapter 1 begins, as all the chapters do. What's one of the things I like about the book is it begins with a little bio of one of the saints. Occasionally, like the second chapter is actually going to be a little story having to do with Moses. But each chapter begins with a little story like that. Many dealing with Americans, American Catholic Church figures, modern Catholic Church figures to help us to connect with that. Same as with Ann Seton. Is a really remarkable woman. And I have a particular connection with her where she founded her community and where the mother house of her community, the Sisters of Charity, is now Emmitsburg, Maryland. And I attended seminary in Emmitsburg, Maryland at Mount St. Mary's Seminary. And in fact, the year that she was canonized, a saint, which would have been 1975, I had just gotten to Mount St. Mary's when and a few weeks after we got there was when the official canonization took place over in Rome. But there at the Mother House, there was a lot of activity. There was a lot of things going on. There were bishops from all over the country who were coming there to celebrate Mass there and to be a part of this great celebration. Elizabeth Ann Seton is the first native-born United States citizen to be canonized a saint. Now, there were other saints who came from Europe and then eventually became a United States citizen, but she was a citizen who was actually born in the United States. When she was born in 1774, and she was raised in an Episcopal family in New York City. She married a man named William Seton, who was a man who was a very successful businessman. They had three girls and two boys. Now, after they married, several years later, his business fortunes began to kind of fall apart, and also his health began to fall apart. And in 1801, they made the decision to move to Italy, because really his businesses had gone to pot here, and he needed to get started. There was a family that he was familiar with in Italy who was willing to take them in and help him get started over there. They went over in 1801. The family they stayed with are known as the Felicis, and they were an Italian Catholic family. 2 years after they went to Italy, William dies, and so there she is. She's a young mother, a young widow, with these five children. She's there with this family who were very supportive and encouraging of her. She saw the strength of their faith, and so she began going to the Catholic Church, and then she began not just going to Sunday Mass, but she began going and praying before the Blessed Sacrament, and eventually her heart began to lead her to the Catholic Church. She did not make the decision to become Catholic until she came back here to the United States and back to New York City, and there she became Catholic at great cost to herself, because her family and friends rejected her because of that decision. It's very hard for us today to appreciate what a hostile environment this country was for Catholics at that time, at the late 1700s and early 1800s. Before the Constitution of the United States was established, There were states, for instance, Massachusetts, where a Catholic priest, it was against the law for him to be there. And if he was caught celebrating Mass, then he would go to prison because of that. The Catholic Church was seen as foreign. It was seen as dangerous. It was seen as something to be opposed. And this continued even after the Constitution. You know, we're all familiar with the Establishment Clause that is part of the Constitution that says that the United States will not establish any national religion. But what we might not be aware of is that that does not mean that a state cannot establish a state religion. And many of them did. In fact, up until 1833 was when the last of the states stopped the whole concept of a state religion. But there were a number of states that had state religions. None of them, that state religion was Catholicism. But there was great hostility. And so when she became Catholic, it was a great cost to herself. But obviously she is seeking, she is searching, and she is for God, and she finds him there in the Catholic Church, and she gives her heart to this. Elizabeth Ann Seton makes her way down to Baltimore, where she connects with the Bishop of Baltimore and begins a Catholic school there. Elizabeth Ann Seton, who is also known as Mother Seton, because she was the mother of the founder of this community, is really seen as the founder of the Catholic school system in the United States. She was not the only one that was running a Catholic school, but it was her influence, her impact, that led to the widespread founding of Catholic schools here in the United States. Again, she eventually moved from Baltimore up to Emmitsburg, Maryland, which is right on the northern border of Maryland. We were just 10 miles from Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. And there she founded this community of the Sisters of of Charity. You may be familiar with the Sisters of Charity if you're familiar with Mount St. Joseph's College in Cincinnati. That is the community that runs that college. That is their college. They are an educational order. That is their charism. That is the ministry that they are primarily focused on. But again, we see in Elizabeth and Seton, we see in her a model of this idea of a soul that is searching for God. And that's where we begin, is we begin with our own human experience. Now, I am a huge, 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 huge Bruce Springsteen fan, all right? I cannot overstate that, all right? I've seen him about 20 times. The last time was 2 weeks ago when I drove to Nashville to see him. There's none other person in the world that I can imagine driving to Nashville to see in concert. But I was glad to do it to see The Boss. I love Springsteen. And Springsteen, one of his songs is entitled Hungry Heart. And the line says, everybody has a hungry heart. Everybody has a hungry heart. And that's really what we're start talking about tonight, is the hungry heart of the human being. Everybody experiences this something in ourselves that is constantly searching and longing for something more, something greater, something other, and that is really never completely satisfied in this world. Because of the fall, what was happened is that God really created us this way. He created us with a hunger that only He could satisfy. But because of the fall, we tend to get confused. Don't remember another song, Looking for Love in All the Wrong Places? Well, we're looking for God in all the wrong places. But it's God that we are actually searching for. It is only in Him that we will find what we are looking for. A couple of weeks ago, we had the Feast of St. Augustine. And probably the most famous line that St. Augustine has from his Confessions is, "You have created us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in Thee." That's that hungry heart. That hungry heart. Now, how do we experience this? I know in my own life I get kind of off balance sometimes, and sometimes it's actually in hunger. You know, I have this thing, I don't know whether you've ever done this or not, where I'll be, if I have, you know, a night at home, and I'm sitting there and watching TV or reading or whatever, and I'll get up and I'll go to the refrigerator and I'll look in there, and I don't see anything I really want, so I close it and I go back and start watching TV or I start reading or doing whatever I'm doing, and 15 minutes later I'm back out in the refrigerator and I'm looking in there again, and I can do this 7 or 8 times in a night, all right? And not stop and think, now, what is it you're looking for? Because clearly it's not in the refrigerator, all right? Clearly it's not there. I think I'm looking for God. I think what I'm feeling is that hunger for God, but then it gets distorted, all right? It gets distorted. Another kind of my searching that is, speaking of TV, luckily I live alone, all right? Or at least I live in my own kind of apartment, and so I don't drive somebody else completely stark raving mad by this behavior. I love the remote control. And I can sit and I can watch TV for an hour and essentially channel through the entire time. So I'd probably go through the entire set of channels, possibly, 20 times, all right, in an hour. The only time it really becomes a problem is when I'm on vacation. Monsignor Solti, who's down at All Saints in Walton, usually goes on vacation with me, and it makes him nuts, all right? We're sitting in the hotel room, and I'm just doing this all night long. And he says about me, he says, you don't care what's on, you only care what else is on, all right? That's all that matters to you. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. And again, what am I looking for? I've sat here all night long, and clearly whatever it is I'm looking for is not on, all right? I think that that's that God thing. I think it's that God hunger. It's that God desire that I'm getting confused about. We do this all the time. We do this all the time where we get off track and we start trying to satisfy this deep, deep longing for God. We can get into it with food. We can get into it with work. We can get into it with possessions. We can get into it with alcohol or drugs. We can get into it with the internet and with porno. We can get into, all of these things. In the early part of the 20th century, there was a British Catholic writer who was just a phenomenal writer. His name is G.K. Chesterton. And Chesterton addresses this in one of his works, and that even when we fall into sin, even in sin, what we're doing is we are looking for God, but we get off track. And so he uses an image that is a little shocking, and I like it, shocking images, because they tend to stay with us, all right? Where he says that every man who ever knocked on a brothel door was actually looking for God. Was actually looking for God. He didn't know that's what he was looking for, right? But because his desire for God had gotten distorted, he was looking for love in all the wrong places, looking for God in all the wrong places, right? But this is all of us in whatever sin we tend to fall into. Whenever we feel that hunger and that desire and that longing, it's really for God. It's really for God. And this is how we were designed. This is how we were designed. Now, how do we come to this God? If I was created for God and my heart is restless until I come to Him, how do I come to know God? How do I come to understand God? How do I come to know who God is? We're going to see three paths. In the first chapter, it deals with the first two. The first is creation, and the second is within the human person itself. We've already touched on that some. And then in the second chapter, where we talk about God who comes to seek us, it's going to be revelation, where God begins to unveil Himself and say, here I am, here I am. Start with creation. Again, a quote from St. Augustine that was in the book. He says, question the beauty of the earth. Question the beauty of the sea. Question the beauty of the sky. All respond, see, we are beautiful. Their beauty is a profession. It is a confession, an announcement. See that we are beautiful. These beauties are subject to change. Who made them if not the beautiful one who is not subject to change? We look at the beauty of creation. Look at the beauty of creation. And rather than just getting stopped there, we should be led beyond creation to think, oh my gosh, how beautiful must be the one who created this. If this is how beautiful the creation is, how beautiful must the Creator be? How beautiful must the Creator be? This is way before revelation. This is what we call natural religion. There has never been a culture, a society in the history of the human race that has not felt this human hunger and has not looked at creation and begun to sense that there must be something behind all of this. There must be something more than all of them, what we see. As wonderful as what we see is, there must be something more. And to search for that and to try to understand, what is it that is there? And again, because of the fall, they've gotten distorted, all right? And so sometimes they say, okay, you know, we look up at the stars at night, and instead of just simply being aware that there must be a God behind all of this, they kind of say, okay, well, each one of these is a God, all right? And there's a God in the trees, and there's a God. And so they got lost in that, but they were responding. There was something true about what was happening there. There was a truly religious response that was happening in this human heart that had not yet been guided by the gift of revelation. And so we as Catholics do not write off all other religions as evil. We believe that many of them, these natural religions, are very, very positive, but they're radically incomplete. They're radically incomplete because they lack revelation. But what they are ways in which various peoples throughout history have learned to think about God, to talk about God, to seek God, to try to know God, and to connect with God. All right, Meister Eckhart, somebody else who I love to quote. He is a mystic. He was a great teacher on spirituality from the 15th century. And a quote that I love. He says, every creature is a book of God. Every creature is a book of God. We know how to read it. Every stone, every flower, every starry tree, every mountain, every sunset, every creature is a book of God that can speak to us volumes about who God is and lead us into the heart of God. All of creation is God's great handiwork. He is the great artist. And we want to make sure that we don't get so entranced. This is something else St. Augustine wrote, where he talks about his early life, where he got lost. And he says that it was in the created beauties that he lost his way. And I lost my creator because I got stuck focusing on the beauty of creation and was not able to move beyond that. One of my favorite works of art of all time is the Pietà by Michelangelo, which is at St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. I was on sabbatical there about 10 years ago, and we were in where I was living at the North American College was about a 15-minute walk from St. Peter's. So I would go there at least once a week, sometimes twice a week, and just to go in and just be there. And one of the things I loved to do was just to go down there and stand, and I could stand for a half hour or more just, you know, looking at the Pietà. And it is such an exquisitely beautiful sculpture. It's marble. And it's hard to believe because it looks so alive, all right? It's so alive. It's hard to imagine that someone could take hard marble and make it look so fluid and so beautiful. You look at the face of the Blessed Mother. You know, she's there. She's holding this. This is the moment after the crucifixion when Jesus has been taken down from the cross and he is placed in the arms of his mother. But if you look at the face of Mary, you know, Mary at the time, Jesus was 33. Mary was almost 50, all right? And this is not the face of a 50-year-old woman. In that culture, 50 years old was old, all right? You did not have many people living that long. But you look at her, and what is it you see? You see that young girl, the beautiful, beautiful young girl of the Annunciation who says yes to God. Who says yes when the angel Gabriel comes to her. You see this exquisitely beautiful face there. This is what the yes to God was going to mean. This is the beginning and the end of the whole story, all right? Her yes to God, and here's Jesus' yes to God, which has led to his crucifixion. But you look at her face and the beauty of that, and then you look at the folds of her garment, and just the way they drape, and you think, my God, somebody did this out of marble. And then you look at the body of Jesus himself, and just the humanness of the whole thing. Now, you can look at that and just be amazed at that, or you can also look at that and just think, is that so amazing? What was this man like who did this? And to think that he was 22 years old when he did this, 22 years old when he took a piece of marble and created this amazing masterpiece. Well, we have to be able to do the same thing with creation. To be able to be amazed, just knocked out by creation. But then not to get lost there, but to think, oh my God, what kind of a God must there be who did this? And so all of creation speaks to us of the reality of God. And yet every culture has spoken, has believed in this. Even in the United States today, you know, we are probably the most secular nation in the entire world, and the secular nation in history. And there was kind of the thought among many intellectuals that as secularism grew, that religiosity would diminish. Well, that clearly has not happened in the United States. We're seeing kind of a rebirth of religion and spirituality in our country today, in the most secular nation in the world. In the United States today, it is only maybe 5% of the people in the United States who absolutely reject the idea of God. Right? Only about 5%. It's a very, very small percentage. Unfortunately, they all teach in universities. All right? That's the tragedy of the whole thing. They have great impact because they're teaching your kids. All right? They're teaching your kids and trying to poison their minds against the beauty of the Creator who is behind all of this. So, you know, we look at creation and we see the order of creation, the way it all works. Must there not be a mind behind that? And we look at the harmony, just how it all works together. It doesn't just work, but it works so well and so incredibly. And then just the beauty. Each one of these things lead us to an awareness of God. So there's the beginning. There's the beginning of the search for God, the search to satisfy the longing of the human heart. Then the human person itself. We just look at our own desire, that desire for God. He said, could we have this kind of a hunger and there be nothing to satisfy that? I mean, we have this, the longing of the human heart is the longing for love. Not just a little love, perfect love, complete love. Every one of us, at the deepest part of ourselves, no matter how much we've already been loved, we long to be loved more completely and more fully, to know love deeper. We long for fulfillment. We long for purpose and meaning in our lives. We long for truth. We long for peace. We long for eternity, not just to be a temporary little blip in the history of the universe. Ultimately, we're longing for happiness. Happiness. Because that's really what fulfillment is happiness. It's having what I long for in its perfection. St. Thomas Aquinas, along with Augustine, these are the two greatest minds that the church has produced in its history. And St. Thomas Aquinas, this great, brilliant man, this incredible philosopher and theologian, said something that's very simple and very basic, that we can only choose happiness. We are incapable of not choosing happiness. Every time you choose to do something, it's because you think that's what's going to make you happy. Now, I know there are people out there saying, well, I give up things all the time for the happiness of my kids. But that's because you think that the happiness of your kids is what's going to make you really happy. Yes, we do set aside some things that we see as relative happinesses in order to have something that's greater. And so we make those sacrifices and those choices always. But he said it is impossible for us to choose not to be happy. Now you might think, okay, I'm going to prove Father Mike wrong. And I'm going to go do it. I'm going to choose something that does not make me happy. But I'm going to tell you, that's because you think proving me wrong will make you happy. All right? You can't do it. It's not possible, all right? This is how we are designed. This is the hardwiring of who we are as human beings. Now, again, because of the fall, we get confused. We get lost. We go searching for God in all the wrong places. But the human soul, you know, when we imagine the soul, if you try to visualize the soul, at least for me, kind of how I've historically done this growing up, is I imagine the soul as almost like somewhere inside my body, all right? Kind of like an invisible organ somewhere inside my body. And I think there's something really radically wrong with that image, because it means that the soul is small, all right? The soul is infinitely large. Our souls are so immense that the only thing that can fill them is God. Jesus says, what does it profit a man to gain the entire world and lose his soul? I mean, we could put the entire world, we could have all of the universe, we could possess that, and it would not be enough to fill up that emptiness within the human soul. Only God can do that. So our souls are infinitely large, and can only be filled and satisfied by infinite God. Now, this is all true. If we have this longing for God, what happens? Why is it that so many people get lost and they don't find God? Well, I think there's a number of different reasons. First of all, as we said, there is the fall itself, where we kind of get confused and we go looking for God in all the wrong places. But there's also the scandalous behavior of believers. One of the major reasons that Christianity has not been more successful at bringing the Christian message to the world is because of Christians. Right? Is because of the poor witness, the bad example of so many people who claim to be followers of Jesus Christ. Either by just, you know, horrendous behavior, or by saying, I believe, but then not living anything there. It doesn't show. And many, I mean, Mahatma Gandhi, right, one of the great spiritual masters of the world, and he loved Christ. I mean, he looked at the Sermon on the Mount as one of the basics, a basic text for his own nonviolent beliefs and system, and he was a Hindu, and people said, why don't you become Christian if you love Jesus so much? And he said, if I ever saw a Christian who really seemed to believe in Jesus, then I would do it. But he saw the timidity, the half-heartedness, the lukewarmness of Christians, and this is what many see. So why would I do that? But just in terms of God itself, you know, I listen to sometimes to people on TV, and some of the ones who are really anti-religion, and they certainly can get my ire going. But sometimes if I stop and think, okay, how did they get this way? And some of the things they're saying, you know, about religious people are not all wrong. You know, about the kind of negative, narrow-minded, mean-spirited behavior and attitudes that we sometimes see among religious people, right? Right? And so much of this has made it very difficult for some people to understand and to believe that, okay, what I'm looking for is God. And so they go looking everywhere else. They go looking for everywhere else instead of that. Suffering and pain. I think, you know, many people, because they have gone through terrible, terrible suffering, ask some really hard questions. If God is good and loves me, and God is all-powerful, why is he letting these terrible things happen to me or to other people? This is one of the most difficult questions that any of us have to ask. A writer some of you may be familiar with, a Jewish writer, his name is Elie Wiesel. And as a young boy, he and his family ended up in one of the concentration camps in it was not in Germany, I think it was in Hungary. But all of his family died. He survived, and he has become a major writer and promoter of awareness of the Holocaust. And he has a book called Night. And in the book, he tells a story. It's a fictionalized version of his story. All right, so it's probably 90% true, but it's told in the form of a novel. And Wiesel has lost his faith. You know, he went into to the concentration camp. Describes that he was this child who was almost a prodigy in terms of spiritual seeking and learning and being trained by the rabbis and but that was all wiped out by what he saw going on in the concentration camp, in the Holocaust, that his faith was just crushed, that there could not be a God. There could not be a God that could allow this. And the book is introduced. And I forgot to look up, I can't remember what his name is, but it's a Catholic novelist from France who writes the introduction to the book. And does so very much from his Catholic perspective. And he tells a story, or quotes a story that Wiesel tells, of seeing a young, beautiful child being hung in the concentration camp, and of what that did to his soul, seeing this beautiful, beautiful child being destroyed in this way, and asking that question, how could there be a God? He said, on that day, that was the day that God died. That was the day that God died for me. And this writer says, you know, just quotes that. And he says that where Weissel's faith ended, our faith as Christians begins. It is in the suffering and pain. Here's the answer. This is the answer to how can a good God allow these things? Where is God? Where was God in the Holocaust? Where was God in the Holocaust? The God on the cross says he was there in the concentration camp. Every child, every man or woman who died and suffered, God was suffering that too. When you look at the history of slavery in this country and the horrible suffering of individuals and groups and families, where was God? Where was God? He was there suffering with them. He was suffering with them. He doesn't promise us, I'm going to take all of your suffering away. He says, I'm going to stand with you. I'm going to stand with you in it. But again, suffering can lead people to abandon their faith. And I've talked to many, many people. I've talked to parents who have lost a child. And I've been with them shortly after, you know, within hours after they've lost a child. And they are angry. The rage and the pain and the sadness that is in them and the why? Why would God allow this? What kind of God? What kind of God could allow this? And it's a question that we can't give cheap answers to. Actually, in the midst of that, my answer is, I don't know why. I don't know why. God doesn't promise me that He's going to give me an answer to all these questions. And He doesn't promise me that there's going to not be suffering. He simply says, I'll be with you. I'll be with you in the suffering. I will bear that suffering with you. But anyway, this is one of the reasons many people do not come to God or are led away from God. Some people, nobody's ever told them about God. You know, we live in a post-religious culture in some ways. There's a group that I belong to. It's a recovery group that I have belonged to for almost 23 years now. I remember being at one of the meetings, and we always begin the meetings with a serenity prayer, and we would close with the Lord's Prayer. And there was this one young man who was at the meeting one time, and this was the first time he'd ever been to a meeting. He had told us that at the beginning. So I went to him after the meeting just to welcome him, and he said, you know, I really like that prayer. And I said, oh, you mean the Our Father that we pray? You mean the Serenity Prayer that we pray at the beginning? He said, no, that one that you all prayed at the end. He had never heard the Our Father. You know, it amazes us, but we live in a culture where people can grow up and never hear the Our Father. They can grow up and never be exposed to that, all right? So there are people who are hungering for God, they're searching for God, but nobody's ever helped them, nobody's ever taught them about God. And so they don't know where to search, they don't know where to look for all of those things. Know that the final thing is personal sin. All right? We can destroy our own faith, we can destroy our own relationship with God, because we can get so lost in our own personal sin that we destroy our vision of God, our capacity to trust and to believe and to connect with God. So all of that.